Recording.
Ah, the heat is off.
The heat is off.
I knew that was coming.
Butterscotch
Shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 135 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm a walking off by one error.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is January 2.92018, exclamation mark, warning. Anything can happen on this show. There's going to be profanity, and then we'll talk about stuff. So if you don't like swears and curses and hexes, get out of here.
There will be many hexes.
Yeah.
So it seems like your strategy has increasingly become to just make unparsable date formats.
Yeah, I was trying to put that together, but I couldn't do it as fast as you were. And then the exclamation mark just threw me off.
Just, yep, that was my sort of 1-2 punch. Like, if you thought you knew where the next hit was coming from, boom, punctuation right in the mouth.
Welcome to 2018.
Listen. What? Listen. We did the Global Game Jam last weekend. What's that about?
And last weekend is in yesterday.
Yeah. So for starters, Global Game Jam. It's a giant worldwide event.
Some would call it global.
30,000 people, right?
30.
That was last year, I think. I don't know what it was this year, but it's usually more.
I think this year was 93 million people.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Great growth rate. This was also the 10th anniversary of the Global Game Jam. It's been going for 10 years.
Or the 11th, depending on who you talk to, or the 9th. It's a little unclear.
Or the 1st.
Who knows?
We don't really know. Nobody's been keeping track, I guess.
But apparently the Global Game Jam has changed ownership like 3 times since its inception.
Oh, I didn't know
that's kind of weird, too. It was owned by the IGF for a while, and apparently they weren't really doing anything with it, so then it became its own organization. But it was started by just some randos that you're not in a basement or something before that. So it's a weird thing.
So the first Global Game Jam was global in the sense that it was on the Earth.
Well, probably somebody probably somebody tweeted it, and then they were like, this is a global event now because
some dude Twitter. Over in Poland also did it or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah, so this is, I think it's a little bit sort of offensive, you know, because almost every game jam is global now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel like they've really sort of taken the wind out of everybody else's sails.
By kind of claiming to be the global game jam.
Because as we all know, the Butterscotch Shenana Jam coming up June 8th, 2018.
It's also global. How would somebody sign up for that to be a part of this global, other global game jam?
They would just go to itch.io/jam/bscotch2018.
Nice.
Yeah. I think that's what it is.
We've already got 75 people signed up or something like that.
I think you can also go to bscotch.itch.io, I think, and just like find
it. It's in there.
It
I don't know.
It's something. It. It's just there. You go to the jams page and just scroll over to June. It's June 8. So I want to say one thing first before we get into talking about the jam and its meat, which is the keynote video. So every year, Global Game Jam has a video that they show. And last year, the video was made by Extra Credits.
It was amazing.
It was just, you know, how to make a good jam game. And it was awesome and very well put together. This year, the keynote videos, plural,
were different.
They had a different tone. Than last year. I don't want to spoil it.
I think the thing to do is to watch both of them back to back.
It's all one video.
Like we had.
It's all one video. Just go to YouTube and just type in
GGJ.
Yeah, Global Game Jam 2018 keynote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is an experience. And bear in mind that at the beginning of the Global Game Jam, you are a captive audience because they claim, oh yeah, the Global Game Jam, it starts at 6. So you got to be there at 5:45, but it doesn't really start at 6. It starts at 7. They trap you in a room for an hour and subject you to
this video.
It was a thing.
I think I got mental whiplash from it. It was weird. So
yeah, going from the hype of the jam into the first video,
and then it was like the second one.
It pulled you down, and then the second video pulled you out.
Yeah, just
like
just
sideways
into another dimension.
And then it was back to talking about the jam, and everybody was just like, "What the fuck is happening?"
It was interesting.
Yep. So watch that. It's crazy. Okay, so what we did for the jam is we've done roughly 4,000 jams.
Approximately.
Yep. And so And we've even done jams that last a matter of a handful of hours. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the sort of excitement of a 48-hour jam sort of isn't quite where it used to be for us. So we've done stuff in the past, like when we did the Shenanigans Jam last year, we thought we're going to make a strategic card battling game with online multiplayer, right? Because
never done that before.
Yeah, because since we make games full time, then we're always developing tools to make things easier and faster, which means a lot of the challenges that are present for somebody just starting making games in a game jam, we don't have those. So we have to keep upping the ante because we've created shortcuts for ourselves over the place.
And that jam was the one that produced what has now become Scuffle Buddies.
Right. So jams are incredibly useful for us and we love doing them. But where we're currently at with the studio is because we are in the midst of a small game project, then the purpose of the jam wasn't quite mm-hmm. what we needed it to be.
We've done this before, like the Global Game Jam in 2016 came the week after we launched Crashlands, or like 2 days, I think, after we launched Crashlands.
Mm-hmm. So we were just in Crashlands.
Yeah, we were mode. Just like, we're going to pass yeah. this year. But I think we've only missed in terms of not sort of doing some form of jam participation. I think one or two.
Yeah.
So this year we decided to, instead of building a whole new game, because we are currently building a whole new game,
yeah.
a little small one, we decided to work on that for the weekend and approach the jam mindset. So we were here until, I think, like 11 or so every night. Everybody rolled in somewhere between, 8:30 and 9:30, kind of depending.
Yeah, we did put in probably a good 30-something hours of work on the game from Friday mm-hmm. through Sunday.
And it was a lot of fun because I think in particular, it was a really good, overall sort of studio reset after like all the stuff that's gone on, even just the beginning of this year and then just the last couple of years, just to get back into the mode of
just make a thing, get it out there.
Yeah, roll into the office. And then if at, 2 p.m., you're like, I need a break. And I want to go flex it off at the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Then you just go do that.
Go do that.
And so it was super nice. It was a wonderful.
It was good.
A wonderful weekend.
And we also to this week to our podcast listeners, we're giving an exclusive about this game, mm-hmm. which is that we know what it's called. Yeah. It's called Level Head.
We have known actually.
But we wanted to make sure that we could actually call it that. Mm-hmm. So it's called Level Head. One word.
It's kind of like when you call someone a gearhead or something else, right?
Yeah. So we thought it was a fun thing. Because, you got to have a level head if you're going to be playing through a skill-based, difficult sort of platforming game, mm-hmm. right? But also, if you like building levels, then it could be said that you are a level head, mm-hmm. right? So, it works pretty damn well, yeah. I think. It took us about 45 minutes of sort of throwing phrases and ideas out there to find that. And then the consideration and the reason that we wait a while to actually give a name is just because of making sure that all of our legal bases are covered. It's like we ran into that problem with Ruckus a while back.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Where, we talked about it in advance and then turns out that name is taken. So it's always something to be careful of. And as time passes, because the games industry is getting more and more crowded, good names for games are harder to come by.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Because even if somebody has made a game 6 years ago, put it up on iOS for free and it got 2 downloads, mm-hmm. They still have a legal claim to that name, and you can't even use that name on that platform because it's reserved for that game, mm-hmm. right? And we actually have had that experience as well, yep. where we put a game up, somebody with a 5-year-old game with under 5 downloads issued a takedown request, and we had to pull down our game. So it does happen. And so let's talk about the jam. Sam. What did you do
so
the past week?
So I did, so basically what happened the past week was on Thursday last week, we had a really good sort of long form discussion between the three of us about just kind of where we're at and in particular what the studio is looking like with all the changes from the past couple weeks and where that puts us. And so for me, it was a big question where it was like, okay, I feel like my art skills have essentially degraded because I haven't really been doing art in the last year. But also looking at this new platformer project, we have this opportunity then to essentially, have a fresh project that isn't a monster of a thing to build those skills with. And so a big part of it came down to realizing that what I had sort of accidentally done was gotten just 100% into production mode on stuff. And we've talked before about like the learning zone versus the, production zone.
Well, and I'll also consider the mental framework that we've been in historically for every other game project. Either we've done jams where nothing matters. We just need an asset, mm-hmm. right? We need a character. All right, there's a character. It took 8 minutes. It's done. Move on, right? When it was the early days in Towel Fight and Quadrupus, you know, your capacity to deliver art was still developing. Mm-hmm. And so just whatever came out was what we had.
Right.
And then on top of that, we had no money and we needed to get stuff out literally as quickly as possible. And so...
So it was definitely only what we had.
Yeah. Right. So I mean, I think the only way to approach it in that sense is fairly thoughtlessly,
right.
which is just like, just get your hands moving and make the art
right.
and do it.
And so what I did this weekend was we had a few art assets in place that I'd already made from the previous weeks, as well as some environments. And so the goal was to tackle some aspect of this that would actually require me to learn things while I was building them.
Uh-huh.
Yep. A big part of this came from, you know, over the last 2 years, I've watched Adam and Seth both essentially rapidly skill up in their primary disciplines, right? And a big part of that came from them taking the time to do a bunch of refactoring stuff, to occasionally, you know, look out at new tutorials or whatever else that people are putting out about how to do a particular thing or research
say,
tech.
Maybe if I built a system that did this, then that would enable this new thing right. or whatever.
And so a big part of it was that learning was essentially actually built into the work. Whereas the way I've been approaching the art has traditionally been that I just work on it at work. And then any extra time that I could possibly get sort of in the evenings or weekends that also wasn't taken up with all of the other stuff that I needed to do for the studio, which generally took precedent because I was already doing the work, would be given to, you know, like, doing a little bit of drawing practice or something like that. And so what I did over the weekend then was instead of separating those two things out, was just integrate them together. So when I went to start working on some new, these like leafy green tiles that we need for the game, I looked at the old one, which looked like a steaming garbage pile. And
you know, almost literally.
Almost literally. And it just asked the question, okay, how does someone who knows how to do this, actually approach this. And so someone, I found...
Like an expert.
An expert.
You could say.
Uh-huh. And so basically what I did was each day that I would find somewhere between 5 and 6 tutorials from people and then do them before doing whatever the asset was that I needed to
do. See, it's triangulating the approach. Mm-hmm. So you can see all these different ways of making leaves or something. Right. Instead of just going, leaves are green... They are also shapes. Mm-hmm. I will make green shapes. Right.
And so so it was actually really funny because I went from on Thursday, I had actually rebuilt the background for the current environment. And not quite using that sort of learned method. It was being slow and trying to think about it more, but not actually using a tutorial.
Not using reference training.
So what ended up happening then was the works that I made starting on Saturday morning. So Friday, basically, I dreamed of bark and leaves, because that was the tutorials that
you
I was
spent
doing.
The entire day mm-hmm. staring at different bark and leaves.
And I haven't had that, and the programmers talk about this all the time, where you try to go to bed after programming and your brain's still doing stuff. Mm-hmm. I actually haven't had that on the art side for a long time, because I haven't been sort of...
Well, you're doing, not thinking.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. So when I went to bed on Friday, I was like, ooh, I remember this. And so Saturday morning, woke up and banged out this super cool looking log. But again, it was a throwaway piece, just a tutorial thing. And then over the course of the day... And then over the course of Sunday, cranked out a big suite of these environmental assets using all these learnings from it. And so for me personally, it was a huge, I felt great all weekend, super jazzed. Like I couldn't sleep basically at all. I was always having a hard time. I get home at 11:30 and I am tired, but I can't go to bed.
Right. Because you're physically tired, but mentally your subconscious keeps churning on problems. Right.
And so to me, it was really great. It was a tremendous sort of return to form, I think, in terms of actually doing the art as opposed to just sort of producing. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to the rest of this week. And then frankly, just like this being the mode. So I did some thinking this morning about the actual formal process associated with this. And then just sort of have built that, you know, wrote it out, built it out, and then I just have it. And so I just follow the rules of my process. And then hopefully really good stuff keeps coming out.
I think it will.
Yeah. It's been a stupidly large improvement.
The shift between the leaves we had on the start of the day on Friday and the leaves we have in the game now is frankly hilarious.
I think there's a picture of it in the game dev.
Yeah, we posted Discord. It in our Discord, which is at discord.gg/bscotch. Mm-hmm. It's a marked improvement.
I want it to be the case that when someone plays this game, they're like, oh, did you guys contract the artwork?
Because it just looks so much better. Yeah.
Who did the art? And I'll be like, I did it. And I'll be like, hey, shut your mouth.
But I think to me, the interesting thing about this is it highlights the difference between approaching your work as work and approaching it as a
craft.
As a craft, or where you are sort of treating it as like a set of curious and interesting problems to solve, right?
Yeah.
So instead of saying, we need leaves, my job today is to produce leaves, right? Because technically that's whatever that bar is, anything that you can render that technically resembles a leaf, you're done now, right? But if instead you say, my job is to make leaves, how do I make just the best fucking leaves?
Right, and that's actually the framing I've been taking because I think that helps me get away from, weirdly, I don't have, a lot of artists have the perfectionist mindset where I think I have the opposite, which is basically the engineering mindset, which is like,
it's a functional,
it is a leaf.
Piece.
It is functional.
Will the player look at that and feel like it could be a leaf?
Right. Good enough.
Then it's good enough.
Yeah. And I think it was a few times too where I was, you know, I'd be working through a tutorial and then I'd be like, do I actually know how to shade things really? And so I went and that sort of shot me off onto like an hour and a half of, again, like reading through some articles people put together, watching a video or two, and then actually trying it out. And I found a new technique to do it that makes me feel like I have mastered color in like a 3-hour
all
window.
All of a sudden.
Because I'm just not picking stupid fucking colors anymore.
And like, yeah, it reminds me, yeah, it reminds me of that time when we were very first getting started and we had that debate about the color of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sam kept saying, the sun is up there, so obviously the sky gets brighter as you go up.
One would.
And down toward the horizon, it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, nah, man, because there's more air down toward the horizon to catch the light, mm-hmm. and up there is the void of space. So yeah, the sun is
in
up
my
there.
Defense, though, also a huge fireball.
There's a huge fireball.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's a more powerful space or fireballs.
Right. Who knows? There's just a lot more space. You know?
Apparently.
So we had this debate, and I was like, just open the window and look. And you're like, my God. It is brighter down toward the horizon.
Well, this is the joke with artists about always just using a reference. So always, even if you know.
You think you know what something looks like.
Just go look at, just for like a minute. Just go look at one. Because usually you'll realize like, oh, I did not. No, that was actually. So I was making bark for the game, for example. And I've never actually drawn bark before. So we have the log trees in Crashlands. You're about the closest to it, but they're sort of like, they're almost like already made logs, right? Like barkless. And so my definition of wood from like an art perspective is it's a brown thing. And then you
with
have
some swirlies,
a bunch of swirlies that have a one directional, like they go in one direction, right? Not just lines all over the place, but sort of a grain that goes with it. And then I looked at some bark. And I was like, I could render this bark instead of rendering those weird lines, and it will look more like a tree because it's actually what trees look like.
Yeah, right.
Not what processed wood looks like.
Right. The trees don't look like boards.
Yeah.
They look like.
And then I was like, holy shit.
Because they got bark on them.
Because they got that bark.
And so then I did a little tutorial someone put together where you just draw like, it was a tree stump or it was a log, but with bark on it from like a pine tree. And then I used that as the basis for how I ended up approaching the trees in our game. So
what this led to, though, and this is the thing I'm the most excited about, is how this translates into Level Head.
Mm-hmm.
So Level Head, it's a game about building your own levels and then playing them and then sharing them with people. And one of the things that we kept coming back to is like, how do we make these levels just look really good? And Sam was working on the leaf tiles. And he just happened to make a configuration in Inkscape of leaf tiles that were sort of like a cluster of tiles within a single column of tiles poking out from the bottom. And it was kind of weird because it was shaped like a tree, right? So it sort of had a trunk and then a shape at the top. But the trunk of the tree was also just leaves because all we had was leaf tiles. And I was like, what if that trunk shape actually was a trunk? And so then when you were building stuff in the level, anytime you had a single column of tiles going vertically, then they would just become tree trunks.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and then we did the same thing with sideways tiles. And then we added little intersection points and stuff so that basically as you build the level, things just now turn into branches and tree trunks and knots and curves and stuff like that. So the level, we're calling it a context-aware tiling system, where you just grab the terrain tool and you just start, you know, finger painting like you would in build mode in Crashlands. And then just these trees and branches emerge.
Yeah.
It's fucking awesome. It feels really cool to build with.
Yep.
So that's pretty damn exciting. And then otherwise, my big jam thing was working on the path editor for Levelhead, because we want to have the ability to have things moving around in the game. So if you want to have, for example, like an elevator that goes up and down, but then only starts moving when a switch is pressed, mm-hmm. or whatever, and you want to configure how it moves, or you know, there's those levels in classic platformers where there's a certain object in the level that's just always moving.
You got to ride it,
and you got to jump on it, and you know, sloth cycling style,
mm-hmm. or you have to time something just right so you can catch a coin, mm-hmm. off of some jump of a moving platform or whatever.
Yeah, so we want to do all that stuff,
and also the Donkey Kong style. The moving barrels that blast you around. So we do have the barrels.
We do have the barrels. And we want to be able to put them on paths. So then you can have barrels that, you know, that move around and you got to time it.
And we have portals.
We have portals, which we'll also be able to put on tracks. Mm-hmm. So there will be, looking forward to is the person who deviously puts the destination portal on a moving track and you just have no fucking idea where you're going to end up. Because the portal you're teleporting to is just like whipping around all over the place.
Right. And you just got to deal with it.
You just got to get in there and hope for the best.
Actually, because you could put it off screen up high, yeah. and just have it moving back and forth so that you're never quite sure.
You have no idea where you're going
to come out.
Where you're going to come out.
That's going to get real, real interesting.
Yeah, because you know we have the requirement that a level is beatable.
Yep.
Which just means that it has to have been beaten once. So you could technically make a level that does all this devious shit that, like, sometimes it randomly dumps you into a spike pit because you missed time to the portal or whatever.
Yeah, it could be unbeatable, you know, 90% of the times that you play it because of statistics.
Right.
But then as long as you can beat it, then it's fine. Still fine.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a thing. But the path editor is very, I think it's going to be really intuitive and easy to use. But that does mean that it's very hard to build, right? Because making something that's intuitive means the game has to handle most of the complex things.
A lot of ways, actually, watching you rebuild the system repeatedly reminds me of when we were dealing with Crashlands, actually, with the inputs. Because we were like, okay, we want this to be able to work really, really effectively on mobile. And that means you just get one input.
You get one touch.
And so figuring out, like, doing that, rebuilding that one input and how aware it was of everything else that's going on, where the player was coming from and stuff, is very similar, actually, to this exact process where it was like, okay, now we need to be able to do this with this thing. And then that means that everything's broken now. So we got to refactor.
It just is. And so on top of that, aside from the editor for paths, it's going to be, that's done now. And I feel like it's in a good spot. But then the next challenge is actually having things moving on the path, mm-hmm. because we have this problem of some of the things that go on the path are going to be solid objects, like platforms or blocks or...
Well, the elevator example. So if an elevator goes through the ceiling.
Right, because a path is totally unrestricted. Mm-hmm. You can have a path go through a wall, you can do whatever, right? So anything that's on that path will also go through that wall. So if you're standing on that thing and it goes up... It goes up through a ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Does it crush
Do you get crushed to death? Do you just get pushed downward through it?
Do you plop out the side?
Do you squeeze out the side like a bar of soap? Like what do you do, right? Because then the question of what if our solution is we'll squeeze the player out to the side. Well, what happens if you put the elevator in a column, mm-hmm. right,
there's
where
no side.
There are no sides to squeeze out of? Then boy. Then
sounds like we should just kill people.
That's the obvious, easy solution.
Yep. Yeah.
It is fun every time we hit these problems and we think through these are platformers that have these kinds of mechanics. And that is basically you just die. If there's a possibility that you're kind of getting crushed a little bit, then you just die now.
Yeah.
And you can see why, because there's 1,000 things you could do, but all of them create enormous numbers of edge cases. So
Of course, there's the fun part there, which is what that really means is the character basically just says, is it possible for me to be where I am? Mm-hmm. Right. Cause I'm there now.
Just right now. Right?
I'm there now. Is this okay? Right. And if not, then you just die. but what that, which is kind of like how life works.
It is kind of how life works.
Yep. You're like, I'm at the bottom of the ocean. Is this possible for me to be here right now?
Nope.
No. Okay. I'm dying.
I'm dead.
so that's how that works. But then there's that extra layer of sensitivity that gets introduced, which is if that's how that works, then you have to guarantee that the only scenario where a player will end up somewhere that they shouldn't be is if they get squeezed there by a moving object.
Because it could be that you get shot out of a barrel super fast.
And you just bump into something.
The game for a moment thinks that you're inside of a wall that you just hit because you're going too damn fast.
Right. So everything else has to be absolutely perfect.
So I guess it probably has to... the question isn't as simple as just, can I be here? It's,
can I be here?
And then...
How did I get here?
If I can't... Just if I can't, is there somewhere real close by that I could be instead? That would be fine.
Right.
And if the answer to that is yes, then you're probably not dead.
Yeah. And the other stuff... So basically the movement system has to be kind of re-engineered to accommodate all these moving pieces. And then there's other interesting stuff that you don't think about a lot in platformers that we still need to refine, which is things like in Mario, if you jump... If you're like inside of a little nook, little one block hole in the wall or something, you can jump out of there very easily. Even though technically there's no point at which you're standing on the ground and have open air above you, right?
Because sort of like U-shaped.
Yeah. And so when you jump out, the game actually just sort of says close enough and it kind of just jiggles you around the lip of the cliff above you. Mm-hmm. And so you need to kind of build in these, I just call them forgiveness mechanics, where when the player is trying to jump over something or whatever, then you should sort of give them the benefit of the doubt and kind of wiggle their player around it, wiggle their character around it. So we would do that same thing with crushing mechanics or whatever. Yep. Somebody gets squeezed and then we do a little bit of wiggling and be like, can I wiggle my way out of this, out of this crushing situation? And if not, then you explode. So it's all very interesting, very challenging stuff. And that's just the way platformers kind of have to be because they're all about precision movement and stuff, which we've never actually done before. All of our games, like in Quadrupus Rampage, we don't really use collisions. We just do distance checks from
things. I think it's because of that first week you spent in game dev trying just not to get your character to fall through the ground. It's like scarred you emotionally.
I was like, this is just too much.
Just put this away for 5 years, we'll come back.
We'll come back to this. Yeah, because that actually is the case that the first game I ever tried to make that I worked on for about a year was a platformer.
Turns out they're really hard if you're doing them well.
It was not a good one.
Right.
Yeah. So, which hopefully Levelhead turns out to have good gameplay. It's already feeling pretty good.
Yeah, it feels pretty good.
But I think we just need to get that little extra.
A few things.
Yeah, I think it's easy to get the first 90% of a platformer. And that last 10% of like those really fine forgiveness mechanics is what makes it good.
True facts.
So that's what we've been doing for the past week. And that's, I think, all we have for news, right?
Yeah.
So let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our players over at podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your question on next week's episode, or maybe even the next week's episode, head on over there, put some stuff in the text box. First question comes from MAP5597. You guys have been replacing butterscotch shenanigans with other words in your emails. Mm. What are your favorites you've come up with so far? Blinker, sketch, shed nanograms, banana scorch, slap some cans.
That was good.
Others?
Yes, they did. I don't know why, but just randomly after typing that word enough, it becomes, gobbledygook, I think is the term.
You just kind of embrace the idea that it's impossible to spell.
Yep.
You know?
So I just started slam jamming those together for the end of the newsletter.
Slam jamigans.
Slam jamigans? Maybe that'll be great.
I do like butter block chain anigans.
That is something that we've sort of taken to doing as a joke is anytime we have some new thing, we just take the word butterscotch shenanigans and repurpose it. So we made an animation engine that we called the Butter Smooth Shenanimator.
That's
pretty good. Yep. We had the butter block chainanigans.
Well, I'm really excited.
When we rebranded to a blockchain company.
Yeah, I'm really excited about Rumpus as an extension of our overall branding strategy.
Yeah.
The joke is that it's the back end of butter.
I think its tagline should just be Rumpus is our back end.
Yeah.
That should just be it. So everywhere you see Rumpus, if you see its tagline.
Well, but we need to brand the tagline. So it needs to say Rumpus, the powerful back end of butterscotch shenanigans.
The well flexed, the flexing, the salubrious.
It should say Rumpus. End. We've got some good haunches. That's it.
On
that's
our back. Thing.
What's a haunch? Is that your back or your leg? Is it a butt?
I think
it's like a leg butt.
Yeah.
Leg butt.
It's like leg butt zone. Area. Leg butt zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's where like the
hammed glute crease situation.
Is haunch a medical term or a butchering term?
Aren't they kind of the same thing? They're
basically the same. I know there's some overlap. I'm pretty sure a doctor isn't like, well, you've got an issue with your bacon. You know, good. We got it.
But your loins, you could have an issue with your, well, no, that's your groin.
No, your loin is your back, lower, is side it? Back.
I thought loins were like groin. That's what it is on a pig.
No, groin is groin. Loin is something else, I'm pretty sure.
It's on your leg.
So again, I think butchering and medicine are somehow different from each other. I'm
butcher
not quite-
scotch, shenanadoc, I don't know. Yeah. You know?
Whatever you butcher want. Scotch, shenana meat. all right, next question comes from
Shenanigams.
Shenanigams.
Yeah.
Look at them legs. Like that. We had a, for a while, we had a Discord channel in our internal Discord server that for just chatting about stuff and hanging out, and it was called Shehangagabs.
It was so hard to read.
Shehangagabs. It's for hanging and gabbing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, next question comes from Koolaboola, who says, are you not afraid of poison gummy bears? A psycho from the internet might mail poison food. Do you eat everything strangers give you?
First of all, I could definitely fight at least like three poison gummy bears.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not afraid of
they're
them.
Very small.
Yeah. They're very
it's
weak.
Like a poison arrow frog.
They spend no time.
You just juggle them really fast and they can't hurt you.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah. They're very tiny. So small amounts, I feel like I can handle.
Well, it depends on how fast they're moving. Now, if a poison gummy bear is fired from a cannon, a very tiny cannon, also known as a gun, I guess, that's gonna hurt.
It's gonna hurt, but is it? But how badly though? Is it
just gonna splash? It's probably like a paintball, you know. So if it hits
it'll
you
be
in
coming
the,
out very fast,
if it hits you in the eye. Now, see, Sam has no eye protection because he's got LASIK now.
But
so
I do have laser eyes now.
That's true.
So I can just blast it out of the air.
Yeah. So I guess.
But can you flavor blast it out of the air?
If only. These aren't flavor lasers.
I think getting shot by a poisoned gummy bear out of a gun, that is being flavor blasted.
That's true. Yeah.
If you get
especially because coming out of that kind of velocity, because of course there's gonna be some inertia problems there because a gummy bear is so, so rubbery and gooey.
Yeah.
That it probably actually just turn into a liquid.
Well, that's what I was gonna say, actually. I think it's because of the acceleration. Because like when you fire a bullet,
it goes from zero to real fast.
Zero to real fast, real fast.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
So you can't actually fire a gummy bear from a gun. You have to fire it from a rail gun.
That's true. Yeah.
Right.
Which is going to have time. You got to give it some time so it has a slower acceleration. Yeah.
So you probably need some kind of an apparatus that's very long.
You need magnetic gummy bears.
So probably you would need to mount this thing on like a Humvee with a top mounted turret that has a very long barrel to give the gummy bear time.
So you'd probably need to use the sort of multivitamin gummies, because they have a lot of iron in them. Mm-hmm. So that way you can get that magnetic.
Right. Or you could put them in a magnetic casing sort of a thing.
Yeah. But that's kind of cheating though, because now it's an actual bullet.
Yeah, but there is a gummy bear in there.
That's true.
So
that was the only requirement.
So I think long story short, not really afraid of poison gummy bears, except for under the scenario that they're fired out of a rail gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and encased in metal.
Encased in metal.
Also, aren't those basically poisonous anyways? Because don't they just like clear your bowels out,
No, that's the sugar-free
ones.
Are you talking about rail guns or gummy bears?
both would do the trick.
Different methods.
They would.
Yeah, there's these. I'm only afraid of sugar-free gummy bears, which are poison.
They are poison, yeah.
There's this, if you want a good time, just go to Amazon and look up the Haribo sugar-free gummy bears.
Read the reviews.
The reviews, oh man.
They're just laxatives.
The tales of horror that have come from these.
I love how every so often there's a particular product that its review section becomes a competition to write review, like the most incredible review.
There are tens of thousands of reviews of people hilarious. Just telling the stories of how they ate a single one of these gummy bears and then tried to go about their day and then shit hits the fan. Yeah. All right, next question comes from Warhaft. Not divulging your darkest secret, what skills do the three of you use to create B-Scotch ID? Skills meaning languages, tech, frameworks, and other badassery.
The most important skill is not worrying about the fact that I have no idea what I'm doing.
Your most important skill is arrogance and confidence sort of mixed together.
What if it actually is not even arrogance, because arrogance implies that you think you know better, right?
Well, that's
that you
true.
Can do this.
It's more like a Zen state.
It's more of a confident Buddhism.
Yeah. Well, there's a line from a book that I was reading recently about how one of the things that we tend to call brave is when somebody goes out and takes a risk, and they do something that clearly is not a wise move. But he made the point that actually probably almost all the time that that's happening, it's because people don't understand the risks that they're taking.
Correct.
Right.
Well, that's the joke with anybody who, you know, 5 years like us into having a business, they're like, would you recommend other people to do this? And the answer usually is no. Because yeah. I learned.
It's very hard. It's very
hard. But also you discovered how unlikely it was for you to have succeeded Correct. For 5 years, right? And how most of it, there's an enormous fraction of it is luck-based and mm-hmm. so on. And so I think in the same way that starting a company requires you just to not be aware of what you have just stepped into, making B-Scotch ID was the same sort of scenario. Because I literally said, I don't know any web development. I'll go learn things that are web things and then make this. Mm-hmm. And so that was, if I hadn't realized how bad of an idea that was, then, you know, I mean, if I had realized that, I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
And it was a bad idea, but because I didn't know that, then it was fine and it worked
out. Here's the interesting point about it is like this idea of it being a bad idea is weird, right?
Because yeah, bad it idea worked. In that it was very risky.
Yeah, but it worked.
Yep. So then it's fine.
You got the job done.
Yeah. Ideas exist on a spectrum of goodness to badness, mm-hmm. you know? And really we always judge them by the outcome,
right.
sort of in retrospect.
But I think it's actually true for most of the stuff that we've done in the studio. Is the only reason we did it was because we weren't even able to know what other people were saying about that thing because they would have told us that it was a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. And then we wouldn't have listened.
And maybe we would have though, because we have listened to some things people told us were a bad idea and we probably shouldn't have.
You know? That's true.
But
That's
there, true. There was a blissful unawareness period where we knew so little, we couldn't even ask questions about, you know, from
people. So you just do stuff.
So you just have to go do stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the perfect, like that blissful ignorance phase is what you need to just go do a thing that is probably a bad idea because it's probably not going to work. But if right. it does, then it's really cool.
So this reminds me of, I was just reading, for some reason I was looking at NVIDIA just as a company because I'm really curious about what's happening to them with all of this crazy cryptocurrency shit, right? Because like graphics cards,
selling like hotcakes.
Flying off the shelves. They cost thousands of dollars now, even though they're the same as they've been. You know, they're always improving slightly, but they're just demand has gone up. So I was like, I wonder how NVIDIA is doing these days. And the first article I saw was not about NVIDIA, but actually about some hedge fund manager who sold his NVIDIA stock the other day. And there's a big hubbub about this. Cause this hedge fund guy has consistently outperformed the market for 10 years, right? And they were like, for example, last year in 2017, you know, the stock market went up by 20.8%. And this guy got a 21% return on his stock, right?
God.
And so I was reading this article and I was like, this is that exact thing, which mm-hmm. is survivorship bias, mm-hmm. right? So there are millions of hedge fund managers.
Mm-hmm.
One of them.
This is a monkey typewriter situation.
Yeah, one of them will have outperformed the market for 10 years in a row, just statistically.
The problem is because he's a human, that means he's like, I must be able to do this on purpose.
And because everybody else is humans, everybody else agrees.
They're like, wow, you must be able to do this.
So now this guy sells his stock in a company that has never had a better opportunity in the market to make shitloads of money. And his reasoning was, well, I have a lot of stock in that company and I think I should have less, right? Mm-hmm. So, and everybody's like, I don't get it, but he has outperformed the market for 10 years in a row. So this is the point, which is you're not going to hear about all the other hedge fund managers who haven't done so well or who have just done the same as the market, who maybe also sold their NVIDIA stock or who bought some NVIDIA mm-hmm. stock and maybe they'll do better than this guy next year, just randomly, because that's how the market works, right? So you just always got to be careful when thinking about hearing success stories and stuff like that.
Because
survivorship bias, it's a real thing.
But on nuts and bolts level, what programming languages do you use now?
So old school B-Scotch ID is MySQL, PHP, and badness. Like that, mm-hmm. it's that combination. Mm-hmm. The new one.
Badness is new hip language that all the kids are using. Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's sort of your starter language. It's kind of like Dr. Scheme. I don't know if you remember that from back in
the I remember computer Dr. programming. Scheme. Yeah.
Some little wacky, weird educational programming language. But anyway,
I remember being really confused about it. Just not about how to use it, but just that I was using it. Because I had never heard of it before.
Yep.
And every programmer that I talked to had no fucking idea what it was.
Yep. And we were supposed to Python existed and is the better starter language. So Who knows?
I don't know.
That's just life and education, you know?
Yeah.
So that was old school Beastcatcher ID, and Rumpus now to replace it is a much more modern stack. So I'm going full JavaScript because that's where the future is. So JavaScript everywhere. So I'm using MongoDB as a database, which is really cool. So if you're into databases and you've only been using MySQL, just go look into some Mongo. It's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then Node, which is just JavaScript again, only now it's on the server, which is also really cool. And then Docker, so I can have fake servers and have, you know, infinite robots doing my bidding. So that's pretty cool. And
that's then, Docker is where they pull their ships in to unload.
They do have a very cute little logo, which is a little whale with a bunch of containers on its head. So it's pretty nice.
What does it mean? I don't know. What does the whale have to do with
it? I'm not 100% sure, but it's very cute. Mm-hmm. And then Vue.js as the front end thing
for the end. You know, there's the
part that the person looks at.
It's not the rumpus, but it's the other end.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's for the end. It's for the end user
on the front end user.
I guess.
Yeah. So if our web tech is sort of a creature
that has two ends.
But has
one
two
is
ends.
Its rumpus.
One is the rumpus, yeah. And then the other end
is Vue.js.
Is the front end,
right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. But rumpus is like huge.
It's enormous and powerful.
Very powerful.
Yeah, it's like an iceberg. You know, you can't tell what's there, and then the part that pokes out is
a tiny little face.
Yeah,
just stick it up out of the water,
yep, right.
Blinking. That's the front end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the stack. I mean, it is the wacky thing about web development is you don't get to just go make a website. You know, you can't just learn a language, make a website, mm-hmm. and then that's kind of the end of the story. You have to, cause it's mostly actually about managing machines.
Right.
And so you have to have all these different layers of stuff that are all talking to each other, because also a lot of the work that's happening isn't even happening on your computer. Mm-hmm. It's happening on somebody else's fucking computer, you know? So building that relationship between,
and you don't even know what they have.
No. And
they might not have a mouse,
anything.
Yeah, they might be on mobile. They might be on iOS or Android. Yep. They might be using Microsoft Edge
or IE6.
Yeah,
or something horrible. Yeah, and so the tech that's available. So you control a very small subset, actually a reasonably sized subset of your code and what the thing actually does. But a stupidly large fraction of all the stuff that's happening is not controlled by you at all. And so it's all this building of trying to predict and understand how the whole ecosystem of you know, browsers and other things work. Trying to understand how these different technologies work as people are coming out with new ones every year.
Well, that's on top of the fact that it takes like five languages to do it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And that's why I opted for the full JavaScript stack, because even though it still is a whole bunch of different things, at least they all have the same common language so that I can learn one common language and then look kind of the
extrapolate.
Variations. Yeah.
So this does bring us to the next question, which is from Rampandipus, who says, Adam said in a previous podcast that he's using different tools for coding Beastcatcher ID 2, which is now Rumpus,
yes,
than Beastcatcher ID 1. Why the change, and has it been worth it so far?
So that comes from, in part, because of that whole stack problem, where previously I was using MySQL, PHP, and of course the front-end web stuff, so I was using jQuery and that sort of thing. But that's now complete, just a whole bunch of completely separate things. They have no coherent relationship to each other, because they're so frequently used together, then people have made kind of nice things that link them together, but it's very awkward and cumbersome and just not very pleasant. And then further, it's kind of hard to replicate what you have out in the world in development. And so things were basically, they were becoming harder and harder to maintain and make interesting, especially with like MySQL. Making a change to that database type is a huge pain in the ass, because you have to specify the type and everything has to be the same. And there's no sparse data and all this other stuff. And so I just needed to get away from all of that to a thing where it could be the complete Wild West, where I wouldn't have to know anything ahead of time. I could just start programming. And if I made a change to how my data was structured,
it's just fine.
It would just be changed now. You know, I wouldn't have
to. So basically it was kind of, for the layperson, it was very rigid and hard to make changes and work with.
Yep.
Now it's very flexible.
It's very flexible.
And some might say beefy.
Yeah. And I get that advantage. And using Docker is really cool. So anybody out there doing in development of any sort, but especially web dev, if you learn Docker, that is very helpful.
So do that.
Because that allows you. Because Docker is basically making little fake computers, right? But you make them on your own computer. So you can make a little fake computer on your computer that mimics exactly what your server is going to look like. And so you can do all of your development and do all of your testing on these little fake machines. And then you can take that same fake machine.
So you basically make your own tiny internet.
Yeah, that's exactly what you do. You make your own tiny internet, and you can take that whole tiny internet that you've just made and put it on a server somewhere. And so now you don't have to care about whether you set up all your networking properly or any of that kind of stuff. You just take what you made and you just put it over there.
And you put it over there on a whale, on a whale's back.
Yeah, now the whale just swims across the tubes, mm-hmm. you know, and his containers fall off of his back, and then there you go.
And then you scoop them up with your internet boats.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Duh.
Perfect.
Yep. Simple. All right, next question comes from I am Cade. What is each of your favorite memories from when you guys were kids? Dude, this was digging deep.
I don't really remember anything.
Adam has a notoriously not bad memory.
You probably remember some
just
stuff.
Just not one.
Just I don't have one.
Don't have one.
Yeah.
A memory.
Yep.
I remember, I'll just pull a random one out.
Pull out a rando.
I remember there's these huge ant mounds that were
in
the prairie.
Forgot about that.
Next to the house. And we would go out there with just some honey. And you just put some honey on top of the mound.
And then they just swarm
and
on
then,
it.
Yeah. Like one of them will get some and you're like, oh, that's cool. And then within like 30 seconds, just the whole hive like comes out and just takes all the honey and leaves. And it's real freaky.
Yeah. I remember because we first grew up as very young kids in a bigger city in Iowa. Well, I mean, a tiny, tiny town by world standards. Mm-hmm. By Iowa standards, it was fucking huge. It's basically like, it was like New York City mm-hmm. sized.
It's what everybody outside of the Midwest uses when they refer to the middle of nowhere.
Right.
As I say it.
Is the capital
Des Moines,
of
Iowa.
Yeah, the capital of Iowa. And I remember seeing ant hills, which would be these little tiny
little shitty sidewalk
little,
ants.
Little piles of sand. Mm-hmm. You know, like the size of a quarter. Just sitting mm-hmm. there like a little sand pile. And three or four ants walking around. Then you go out into the real stuff. Out into the prairie. Mm-hmm. You know, in the wilderness. And these ant hills, they're like a foot tall. Mm-hmm.
And four feet
in diameter.
Oh yeah, the big ones. Yeah.
And you're like, is this like just some kind of a terrain piece? Mm-hmm. No, it was constructed by ants. It is fucking huge, and there's a trillion of them mm-hmm. in there.
And if you broke it open, because we did that sometimes, you just go hit it with a shovel or something. Be like, what's in there? And you just whack it with
ants.
A shovel.
Turns out many ants.
Turns out just a shitload of ants.
Yeah, and then they just like, oh, and then they just fix it because there's a trillion of them, and they're like, yeah, this will take a minute, and they just rebuild
it's
it.
Real weird. Yeah, remember that? Chopping thistles, the heads off of thistles with a machete.
Yeah.
That was fun. That was a good time.
Yeah.
You had to wear a helmet, a racing helmet, when you were riding the lawnmower.
It was a riding lawnmower. Yeah. So sometimes you would be mowing and you'd hit a walnut and it would fling out of the lawnmower like a bullet mm-hmm. and bounce off a tree and hit you in the face. Yeah.
The worst one was the pine cones. Cause you go
pine
around,
cones.
You'd have to get up close. You know,
there was a lot of dangerous debris.
Yep. All that.
Yeah. And also, so we come from a farm background. So our family on both sides are farmers. So they have lots of heavy equipment that they then, of course, attach children to for fun.
Because it's awesome.
Because that's what you do on farms. So we would go visit the family, and they would have four-wheelers, you know, eight all-terrain mm-hmm. vehicles. And then they would take a rope, tie it to the back, mm-hmm. get one of those saucer sleds.
A metal saucer.
A metal one. Because,
mm-hmm. yep.
you know, if it hits you, you want it to just you want to feel it. Then they just throw like a four-year-old on there and be like, just hang on. And then they just start whipping around on the four-wheeler out in the middle of a cornfield.
I think we even did it with a truck.
Sometimes did it with a truck. Yeah. And of course,
because you have to go to places where the four-wheeler couldn't get to as well, you know, because it was like really, really bumpy.
Yeah. And they would do it in the middle of a cornfield. So.
Yeah.
So it's technically safe, but then of course there's these rock hard stumps of corn sticking up out of
little
the ground
blades.
To impale yourself on.
I think, and now you're talking about these corn stalks. I remember going out to a friend's house, I think in like sixth grade. He lived next to a cornfield because we're in Iowa. And we went out there.
Everybody lived next to a
cornfield. Everyone lived next to a cornfield. And we go out there, and it was like seven or eight of us. And we just start, you rip those out of the ground. Right. So it's basically a stock with like a handle. So you just rip it out of the ground and then it's got this heavy chunk of dirt on the end.
Mm-hmm. Like a club.
Like a club. So we were hitting each other with them first.
Right.
Someone, you're like kids, you do. And then someone threw one And then it became, and they're like really fun to throw because it's got this really heavy top.
It's kind of like those Nerf footballs, you know, that have the tail on them.
They just don't scream, but everybody else is screaming. Right. So we're out there and just like hurling these essentially dirt clods. Corn stalk in the end of it.
That's about as rural as possible. It's like, we just spent the day throwing dirt clods at each
other. Needed to have also been shotgunning beer to complete it. Right.
Well, we were in sixth grade, so it wasn't quite there yet. But I think
it doesn't stop some people.
It ended when I think one of my friends got hit in the face with this dirt clod. Yep,
that's how it always ends.
Yep. And he got mud just like in his eye, like injected like up in his lid. And it was like really cold mud. And so it was just like stuck in there. And the person who threw it got a splinter. Like it happened. It was like the same instant got like a sliver of corn stalk, just like embedded in their palm. And then, his sister had to help us get it taken out, and we had to wash his eyeball out when we got there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, most of these sort of childhood stories start with a fun time and end with an injury. Like, that's kind of the.
We also used to get. We had our pond we go swimming in, and then we put a dock out in the middle of it, floating dock. And then you dive down to the bottom and you pick up a bunch of this, like, really soft mud.
It's very soft.
It's very soft. Weird. Very soft, weird mud.
And then you could just, like, you could paint with it. You could, like, cover yourself in it with a unicorn. Just covered in mud.
Why? I don't know.
But remember,
we lived in rural.
Yeah, that's what you do.
We lived in rural.
I can remember one of your guys' friends, someone threw mud, hit someone in the eye. Again, common story. And they got mud just
in there.
In there.
It gets in there. It
took them like a few hours to blink it out.
Yeah. I got to say, you know, I feel like this is probably true of most people, is like most of their fond childhood memories do somehow involve an injury.
Yeah.
Like somebody.
I just think those are the ones you remember.
Those are the ones you remember because it was like
something interesting happened.
Yeah. I even remember one time we were skating on some ice and then Adam had a hockey stick behind his head.
Yeah.
So he was kind of resting his arms over it and then tripped.
My arms were stuck.
His arms were stuck, so he couldn't get his hands out in front to stop himself, and he just face planted,
split your lip open.
No, I landed on top of my head because I just kind of like fell.
You like dunk. Over.
Yeah, just, yeah. You got it's yeah because you got your neck, you know, is braced. So good. Good.
I will say though that I learned a lot about how to think about danger and physics from that childhood, and so now, and my wife's always giving me shit because I'm always worried about. Weird things that to her are very weird to be worrying about, you know, and like it's just like literally anything. Because now I'm thinking, because I'm just remembering all the things that we did where somebody got hurt or something caught on fire when it shouldn't have.
Yep.
And you only lived because you were a resilient child.
Yeah.
Right. Like if that happens to you when you're 40, like if you have a hockey stick behind your head,
well, even now, like now I've got fucked up neck bones.
Yeah.
Now, you know,
yeah,
I still like.
You can just be paralyzed from that.
Yeah.
From that thing that happened that you just walked off when you were 12, right?
Well, I also could have been then, too. This is another survivorship bias problem.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, you don't hear about those kids who fell over and then broke their neck because that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's not a fond story that they can look back on.
Yeah. Nope.
Right?
Yeah.
So
I just remember Mom used to give me Lucky Charms in the morning before school, and I'd go and sit by the couch and then very secretly and slowly only eat the marshmallows and then just dump the... under the couch, and she didn't.
Under the couch. Oh,
I just remember the confusing moment. Yeah, of cleaning out the couch, and then just somehow,
just
there's like eight boxes worth of Lucky Charms, just embedded in the cracks of the couch.
Good time.
Not a lot of foresight kids have.
Got the job done at the time.
Yeah. All right. Next question comes from Kulabula, who says, do you think the podcast has brought the three of you even closer? P.S. I'm not talking about spatially. And has it ever,
he knew it was going to happen.
And has it ever gotten you in hot water with your wives?
To the second question, not hot water per se.
It has prompted some interesting discussion.
Yeah. Put it that way. Yeah. It's been good. It's always been good.
It has.
Yeah, so that's been good. And then as far as bringing us together, I think the reality is it's almost like talk therapy on the weekly because this happened actually around Crash Lane's launch. And anytime when we've been going through just a really rough period because we're either working our faces off or
shit's going sideways.
It's this weirdly regular thing.
You can always count on having to take a break and just talk about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important.
So I think it has in that way. And it gives us the opportunity to sort of bounce ideas off each other in a completely different context from work, which I think if we weren't doing this, we wouldn't talk about any of these things. Just a guarantee, basically.
So, we would just move on.
Yeah. It's a nice reflection time.
It is. All right. Next question comes from Chalosis. How does the B-Scotch crew avoid getting sad?
Ooh, wow.
I work at a 6-person studio. In the last months of development, we programmers fix tricky but boring bugs, and future finances seem unsteady. Do you have techniques to stay upbeat and engaged in your tasks? Okay, so there's a couple points there. One is about the work, and the other is about sort of the feeling of uncertainty, right? So to the first point, I think I've never felt like my programming work has been boring. Sort of.
It can be tedious.
There's often tedium, but I actually enjoy the tedium as a not as a constant. Like right. I feel like if that was all I was doing was just like data entry or something, then that kind of sucks. But there is an advantage to doing the occasional tedious task, which is tedium to me is it's thoughtless, right? It's like there's just a lot of things you got to do or something, and you just kind of work through them. But I feel like that's a good break moment from solving the huge, big questions, right?
But if it lasts long enough, it gives you a new problem to solve, which is how do I make this less tedious?
How do I program my way out of this tedium?
Yep. And so then it just introduces a new fun programming challenge you get to go take on.
Yeah. And I think similarly to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode about Sam's art approach, because it was probably the case, because you like what you were saying was the way you were approaching your art before was just you were kind of grinding through it. Getting it out.
Right? It wasn't enjoyable.
But then once you said, how do I just do this real fucking good? Then it becomes an entirely new set of interesting problems. Right. And so if you feel like your work is boring and you're a programmer, then you would just change your approach.
Try stepping back and say, could I add some element of basically learning or discovery in the midst of this big chunk of work I have to do.
And I think that's the difference of sort of taking full ownership over the work
and letting the work own you
versus letting the work own you. Yeah. So if you just say, this is the thing I need to do because it's on my list of to-dos, I'm going to do it. You do it. And then you're done. Like that's one way to approach it. Another is that there is no such thing as just like a task list. There are sort of overarching objectives. And the tasks, who gives a shit? Like, those are just optional ways to go about getting the thing done that you need to get done sort of in the bigger picture. And you should just be finding the best and most interesting ways to solve problems.
Yeah, and honestly, going back to the previous question about the podcast, as far as just general camaraderie and stuff, if you guys can take just like, you know, 6 people, it's enough. You can easily have a conversation that everyone's participating in. Just taking time weekly to just sit down and not to check in to be like, everybody dump your negative shit in here. Don't do that.
Take a lunch break. Never dump your negative shit on anybody.
Yeah, don't get in the trenches and be like, oh my God, we're in a horrible situation. Everything's horrible. But try to have some small chunk of time, whether it's a half hour or an hour, where everyone's together and you're just talking about sort of the interesting aspects of the work that you're doing as opposed to the negative aspects. And this is something you really have to watch, especially with really analytical people, because sometimes they'll get overly wrapped up in, you know, critiquing or in sort of deconstructing their negativity in a way that seems like it's productive, but really it's sort of like an intellectualized form of complaining on the larger scale. And so if someone's talking about their problems a lot, or in particular, if your team just has a lot of, you know, issues you guys are dealing with, then try to get together and reframe it to talk about the not necessarily the positive aspects of it, but talk about it in a way that is not inherently negative, if that makes sense.
Right. From a solutions perspective. Yes. Yeah. So then the other question about sort of future finances seeming unsteady, possibly causing the morale in the studio to drop. This is kind of an interesting, it's an interesting sort of double-edged problem because, you know, we had a conversation quite a while back on the podcast about immortality and how it's dumb because the idea that you're going to die one day is it applies pressure to make sure that like, you got to get shit done now. Like you got to set some goals and do things now. Cause you don't know when you're not going to have the option to do those things anymore. Right. And so, we've been in both experiences where, you know, prior to the launch of Crashlands, finances were always very random and sporadic and we just didn't really have any of them in a lot of cases. And honestly, the feeling of working on stuff in that environment actually felt way better than afterwards. Because you know that if you do things well, then it's going to change everything, right? Once you're fine, then either you'll continue being fine or get worse, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and there's also that kind of tendency to want to double down on the things that you've done that are doing well. And it, like, things just get kind of weird, but I think the way to think about it is if you feel like things are unsteady or like you don't have a lot of control over your circumstance, try to step back and take stock of all the things that you're doing and whether you even should be doing those things.
That's a big part of it.
Because the fact is you're right about, I mean, if you feel uncertain and like you're not sure what the future's going to be, that's exactly correct. Mm-hmm. If you feel certain about it, you're wrong. And that's actually more worrisome.
Right. You can have a safety net.
Yep.
You know, like a financial safety net, but your future is always uncertain.
Yeah. Well, it isn't. Having a safety net doesn't mean your next game is going to be a success. Yeah. So,
right. And sometimes you do feel, if you feel uncertain because say there's some really important things that you guys are doing and there's some other things that are kind of clogging the important work up. Then again, that question of what could we not do? Because that'll actually, that method of paring down the work sort of, it'll extend the runway because you guys won't be working on useless stuff. It makes morale feel better because every day that you come in and you're pushing forward on, you know, one of the suite of things that will make a difference for the studio is way more important than the days of, you know, churning on stuff that probably is moving the needle or just like a little bit of nothing. Yeah. In a 6-person studio, like you can totally feel that on an individual basis. So depending on the project you're working on.
Yeah. And we ran into this scenario in December. We talked about things like we had been looking into potentially doing console releases of Crashlands. And this was right on the heels of the China launch.
Yeah. And anybody who's listening to the podcast knows we've been talking about that for like a year.
Yeah.
Potentially getting on one of the consoles.
Yeah. And we just realized in December, we were like, we just don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, you know, like you guys are talking about this, you know, in your last months of development, you're working on like fixing boring bugs and doing mm-hmm. you know, stuff that kind of feels grindy.
Yeah. Why is there boring stuff?
Right. And it may be the case that you're working on stuff that you actually just don't need to do or don't want to do. And the question is, do you actually have to be doing those mm-hmm. things? And so in the case of the Crashlands console stuff, we thought we could try to put together a new content patch for our players and actually deliver something awesome that we can actually see, you know, mm-hmm. That will get our existing player base excited and re-engaged. Or we can release on consoles, even though anybody who owns a console probably already has one of the many devices that Crashlands is already available for. Mm-hmm. Right?
But we should also say, though, as a business decision, that doesn't necessarily make sense. It's like if you're strapped for cash, putting out an update is probably less powerful than going out on a new platform, depending mm-hmm. on the platform, depending on a whole bunch of things, right? So it's not always going to be the case that that's the choice that you get to make. For us, it is because we're currently fine. And so we get to focus on just where do we want to be spending our time? And it is also launching a new game is always more powerful.
Yeah.
Definitely. But between adding content to an existing game for your current player base and launching on a new platform.
Well, I would say actually it was the best business decision, even though it may not have been the hardest hitting short-term financial decision, right? Because in our case, we looked at the administrative burden mm-hmm. of working with so many third-party companies that have really strong gatekeeping practices.
Yeah, going through cert for yep. consoles
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah, so, and again, like I agree. For us, yeah. for us, it was absolutely the right business. Yeah.
But I think the overall sort of strategy being always bear in mind that everything that you're currently doing could be up for negotiation mm-hmm. and, yep. you should be always rethinking the things that you're doing anyways. So maybe it's time to pivot. Mm-hmm. You never know. So that's, I don't know. You guys have any other final thoughts on that?
That's good.
Nah.
Otherwise, don't be sad. Also, it's winter unless you're in Australia or something like that or South America. Or, you know, anywhere else south of the equator.
The other half of the planet.
The other entire half of the planet.
Yeah. I like winter conceptually, but I always look forward to it. And then no matter, just without fail, it's just a bad experience.
Yep. Yeah.
Winter's just
so
a bummer.
So is summer.
Summer's also a bummer.
Hotter than Hades.
Yep.
I wish there was a season.
But summer's nice to look through windows, you know?
Yeah, and that's true.
Right? Like being inside in the summer is great. Being anywhere in the winter is terrible. There's nowhere you can go because you go inside and you're like, there's not even sunlight coming in mm-hmm. and I'm cold all the time.
You open the blinds and you're like, ah,
I've heard there are other locations in the world
where
the climate is slightly more tenable for human beings.
Are there?
I've heard of this.
Aren't these places where everybody else lives, though?
I know.
That's the annoying part. That's the thing is the weather's great, but then there's these people, you know?
driving up prices.
And I don't know. And the thing, the other thing is
smelly, taking up traffic.
As a Midwesterner, I don't know how to engage with people from places that have nice weather.
Yeah.
Because
what are you gonna talk about in that first interaction?
In the Midwest, you've got two conversation topics. Mm-hmm. One is how great the weather is, mm-hmm. and the other is how bad the weather is.
Yep.
When you take those away from me, I cannot engage. So anyways. Yeah. So that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you all for listening. And we'd also like to thank our producer Fat Bard for making us sound good. And our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. If you'd like to get more involved in the B-Scotch community, hop over to our Discord server at discord.gg/B-Scotch and come say hello. If you'd like to adorn your body with Butterscotch merch, you can check out our shop, which is at shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us stuff, poisoned gummy bears, mm-hmm. whatever. We have
via railgun, preferably.
Via railgun.
You won't need that mailbox unless you're going to shoot it with your railgun.
Yeah, but if you do need to shoot our mailbox with a railgun,
uh-huh.
yep. you can find the location of that mailbox mm-hmm. at mailbox.bscotch.net. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.